So we come again to this practice and it has an element of ritual. This is a ritual that has purpose and meaning, not just a gesture or a performance. But to connect with it as ritual can help us as we enter into a period of practice. The ritual of assuming posture. The ritual of softening the body, of arriving in this moment. And in ritual, there's a great deal that's familiar. So you might be familiar with feelings in the body, familiar with the mood. Maybe you have a meditation mood. Or a sense of connecting. A feeling of arriving at yourself, of remembering who you are. Take some time to scan through the body, what's happening in the body right now. Are there places that need care, softening? Can you come into real stillness in the body? This too is part of the ritual of meditation. Stillness. when the body is very still, can actually create a kind of tension or contrast between the mental activity and that stillness, or between an emotional agitation and that stillness. But the physical stillness can help us to actually quiet the mind as well. We focus the attention on the stillness, and then we bridge the mind and body with the breath. The breath must move, so it can't be still. But as we pay attention to the breath, it helps the mind to calm. It inclines the mind toward stillness. Feeling the touch and movement of breath. Acknowledging the pull away from stillness, the mind that wants activity, distraction. And treating that pull kindly, gently, lovingly, as we guide it back to the breath and the stillness of body. So we're still in this exploration of the seven factors of awakening. I've been kind of in my mind, I've been kind of revolving around them a little bit. They can be sort of seen, as progressive, but I keep finding my mind sort of drawn into one that I'll kind of think about for a while, and then sort of going to another one, and maybe making connections between them. I guess rather than being able to go through these in some systematic way, I'm afraid I fall back on just kind of just reflecting and going in and taking different angles and connections among them. So just to go over this and to put this in the context of the 12 steps, my thinking is that as meditation practitioners, we want to, and as people on a spiritual path, we want to kind of take an inventory of where we are in relation to these seven factors. So that's why I put them in the fourth step, that we kind of take a seven factors inventory. And that's something that's kind of ongoing, and it's kind of, it can help us to look at what needs more development in our meditation practice and what can we also take some joy in that's developed. Then that can point us also to things that we don't understand as much, or that we're kind of trying to see what they are. So the seven factors are mindfulness, investigation, energy and effort, joy, tranquility, concentration, and equanimity. And I've spent a lot of time talking about investigation, I'm kind of, today I was kind of thinking about joy, but also equanimity and also concentration. So, and as I say, they're all related. But let me start by talking a little bit about joy. And I know I have brought this up before, but the Pali word is piti, P-I-T-I, and it refers to a particular state that arises in meditation that's kind of the beginnings of opening into jhana states, the concentration states. And so it has this sort of technical meaning. And that's certainly relevant, but it also can, I think, be too narrow a thing to focus on, particularly when we think about this in terms of recovery. That what I think is, or I'm more interested in looking is at joy really in the not meditative state, but joy in our lives. When I first got interested in this through James Barras, one of my teachers and one of the founders of Spirit Rock, who quite some time ago started to talk about happiness and joy and kind of bringing it into his teaching, because he saw that a lot of people who would get into Buddhism would take it very seriously, and that there could be this sort of heaviness about the way people approach Dharma, and that he felt that was both a misunderstanding and an unhelpful way to think about Dharma practice. And he started with this book called How We Choose to Be Happy that his wife gave him. It was like for Christmas. It was like 20 years ago or something. And you know, when I first heard him talk about it, you know, part of me was kind of skeptical, like, oh, this is kind of some kind of cheesy self-help stuff, you know, happy, happy, joy, joy, you know, but then as the more he talked about it, the more I saw the skillfulness of what he was talking about. And that was interesting, you know, this book's called How We Choose to Be Happy. And the very idea that we choose to be happy was sort of the central premise, or certainly starting premise of the book. And the book is structured around the stories of people who make certain choices, and that they had like 7 choices or something like that, or 9 choices, I forget. And I actually referred extensively to this book in my own book about joy, Recovering Joy. And I tried to build like exercises or reflections around each of these choices. But perhaps I should have, like, if I'd have planned that I was going to talk about this, maybe I would have gotten out one of those books, but maybe we'll do that on Friday. But the premise that I think is important is kind of seeing how we undermine our own happiness in choices we make. And this ties in directly to recovery, right? Because we know that like addiction itself is this, you know, in the simplest terms, an unwise choice, you know, that we make. I mean, it starts as a choice, right? Eventually it stops being a choice, but we start to drink and use or act out addictively as a choice because we think it's a solution to life. And so starting to see how the decisions we make and the choices we make as being directly related to happiness. And so like typically, like one of the choices people make in life is, oh, I'm going to take a job that I hate, but it'll make me a lot of money, right? And that's a way to be unhappy, but rich, you know? And okay, you can choose that, right? That's an option. But if you want to be happy, then maybe you should choose a job that you love, or that at least doesn't, or at least that you don't hate. It talks about how we get pressured into making decisions, that we make decisions based on, we make choices based on social pressure. You know, our family wants us to do something or thinks we should, you know, marry this person or take this job or live in this place. And instead of doing what we want to do, we do what we feel pressured to do. So there's really a sense of freedom that comes with this idea, like I'm going to make the choices that are going to make me happy. Now we can also say that, like, okay, there can be an element of, this starts to sound very selfish in a way. And it's not to suggest that happiness doesn't also come through doing things that make other people happy. But as we know, you know, we have to be very careful about that. Because there is this thing, codependence, where in which the actions we take are really not associated with our own happiness. They're just in order to satisfy other people, you know, in this dysfunctional feedback, emotional feedback loop, in which, you know, we think that if we can make them happy or appease them, that somehow they're going to, you know, take care of us, and those really messy relationships that cause so much suffering in our lives. So this idea of seeking joy as making happiness a priority, rather than being good or doing the thing that we're supposed to do or achieving something, success, so-called success. Look how many you know, successful people are unhappy, you know, struggle with addiction, you know, for instance, so-called successful people. So I know this is will sound silly, but this is when I decided I was going to start to play golf, because I'll take you through this a little bit. So James Barras, you know, he wrote this book, Awakening Joy, but before he wrote the book, he started having courses, Awakening Joy courses, which I took. I think I took it a couple times. And one of the exercises was to just write down things that you enjoy doing. and it was super sweet to do that and to think, oh yeah, I want to both prioritize those things, but I also want to just really appreciate those things, because a lot of them were the simple things in my life around my family and my daughter and my wife. And it's like, oh, seeing that they're, one of the things that's helpful is to see that there are a bunch of things that already make me happy, and to appreciate them and reinforce them in my mind. But one of the things that showed up on this list was playing golf. And the thing is that, you know, I will tell you that, like, there, I have a history around golf. Okay. As a child, you know, I came from a upper middle class family that belonged to a country club, you know, we're very privileged. Of course, I had no idea I was privileged. I was always frustrated because I wanted more, you know. But, you know, I was also an alcoholic family and there were a lot of problems, but we belonged to a country club and I learned to play golf when I was like 7. And I would go out and I would play golf. And, you know, this was like this country club was basically heaven for a child, because it was like tons of swimming pools, tennis courts, you know, all that. And my mother would just drop us off. We never went to camp. I never had daycare. It was like, drop us off at the club in the morning. And my father would pick us up at 5 o'clock in the afternoon and be there all day. And so golf, tennis, swimming, you know, hamburgers. Anyway, that's, you know, my confession about my privileged upbringing, which was also a racist upbringing, because no blacks or Jews were allowed in that club. So, you know, and we were liberals, you know, my parents were Democrats, but anyway, this is, you know, not my family inventory here. So at 16, having, you know, my hair was starting to grow out. It's 1966. I was trying to be a hippie, and my hair was over my ears, and the country club said, you're not allowed on the golf course anymore because your hair is too long, right? Okay, so this, you know, the terrible trauma I experienced as a 16-year-old kicked off the golf course. Well, I was becoming a hippie. I was a musician. My basic attitude was, fuck you and your golf, you know? you know, Republican snobs or whatever I was thinking at the time, you know. I mean, 1966, you know, it's right in the beginning of the anti-war movement, and I was becoming that. And so I did not play golf ever again for decades, and didn't really think about it. But as I got into my 50s, and, you know, something happens when you get older. You know, you start to think about something about, like, I don't know, what is it? Like, I guess you start to remember things, but something was like, oh, you know, kind of like that, you know? So I realized, like, it was something I turned away from out of anger and resentment, and that was something that I actually loved, and so I picked it up again, you know, at 60. My handicap is now about 11, which is actually impressive as hell for for somebody who started at 60. Just FYI, I want you to know. So, of course, playing golf doesn't make me happy. It's, you know, per se, but it was realizing, I mean, the point of this is that I had had a I still am embarrassed. I talk about it with you guys, but I'm still embarrassed to talk about it because I feel that I'm not supposed to do that based on who I am culturally and politically, right? We all know that the current leader, you know, is obsessed with golf, and it's embarrassing to be associated with that. It's embarrassing. I don't like it, but I really love playing golf. So, you know, it's one of those choices. It's like, it's not cool, right? This is like another way that we kind of make decisions that we wind up not being happy because it's not cool to do something. So we don't do it, even though we might like it, you know. We just don't want people to know. Like, oh, I don't want people to know, like, you know. And you know, there's many other activities and things that might be like that, you know, that we associate with something we don't. So how we choose to be happy, I think it's a really great idea. So to talk about this a little bit more in terms of recovery, one of the problems with joy or happiness with people in recovery is that our way of pursuing happiness as addicts was to get loaded. So once we're in recovery, there can be this fear of having fun, or you know, what if I get too excited, you know, or is that safe for me? Like, I'd really like to do this activity, you know, I want to go to see that band, but there's, you know, that's they're playing at a bar, you know, what do I do? And how do I find activities that I enjoy? What do I enjoy anyway? You know, we kind of, it's almost like we wipe out that connection to happiness with drugs and alcohol and our other addictive behaviors. And so one of the things that I think, I mean, what I did obviously was I went back to something pre-addiction. And I think that's one of the things that people can kind of do. Well, what did I really enjoy when I was 8 years old? You know what I mean? Like, you know, when we become addicts, not only do we sort of adopt this destructive behavior, but we do leave behind a lot of other things. Maybe not just because they're not cool, but maybe they seem not, you know, as a teenager, when you start drinking and using, which is usually when we start, we're kind of trying to leave behind childhood. And, you know, you might remember, oh yeah, I really did love gardening when I was a kid, you know, being in nature or bird watching or something, you know, just the simple things. And that's the other thing about addiction. Like, with addiction, we're going for this, we want the big hit. Right? We want the big, you know, let me, you know, stronger, you know, 151 rum, you know. And in recovery, we can kind of start to realize, oh, there are these simple joys, right? And what are they? What, you know, we can become more subtly attuned to what makes us happy. And they can be very, very simple things, you know. It's amazing to me how just opening my front door and stepping outside in the morning can be this really uplifting moment. And I just have to pay attention to it. That's why mindfulness is so important. You know, in recovery, we have this potential, this capacity, this renewed capacity to be awake and to be mindful and to appreciate things and to find joy. And so we start to, so I guess we could sort of combine this with investigation, right? Investigate what brings joy and investigate what is joy. Or maybe you don't like the word, maybe joy is too strong, maybe happiness or contentment, you know, how we define that is very important too, because language, we have a lot of conditioning around language. And the idea of what is happiness is something I've, spent quite a bit of time thinking about. And one of my points in Recovering Joy was that happiness isn't just your mood. You know, that again, that's an addictive thinking, that I've got to keep my mood stimulated. I've got to keep my mood up where, I've got to keep away all the difficult feelings. But that happiness is more about our life. And I have this line in the book, something like, I can feel depressed, but not be unhappy. And sort of explaining what that means, that there can be this very difficult mood, but I know that my difficult mood isn't because there's something wrong with my life or something that I'm not happy about in my life. It's just that this is a difficult time or a difficult moment or a difficult feeling. But it doesn't mean, it doesn't mean something has to be fixed. I don't have to, get out there and like get rid of this feeling, or I don't need to uproot my life. Oh, I need a divorce. I need to move to Ireland, which actually I might need to move to Ireland, but that aside, that kind of, again, that addictive thing of like, this isn't okay. I have to fix it now. And it's like, no, actually it's okay. It's okay. It's okay to be sad. Or it's okay to be anxious. The bigger question is that a symptom of something bigger that needs to be addressed, or is it just a mood? Or is it just this day? I mean, right now, how can we even know, right now it feels as if each day is just it's one day at a time, just to get through each day. And not take any mood too seriously. I don't know how anybody can be in a really great mood for a sustained period of time right now. It's just, there's too much negative stuff happening in the world. So even maintaining just balance. And again, this is why we need to, maybe this is a contrast. Despite the fact that it's okay to have moods, that doesn't mean we shouldn't do things to bring joy, momentary joy, uplifting mood joy. And our challenge as people in recovery, which I think is a big challenge for us, is to find those things. And it takes a real openness, a real willingness to consider what does bring me joy, what does uplift my mood, that's okay, that doesn't harm me, that's not destructive. Going to the farmer's market, and making a great meal. I have a policy, like when it's time to do the dishes, it's rock and roll time. I'm going to find some music and I'm going to turn it up loud. That just almost invariably gives me a boost for that moment. Some song comes on, and I'm just like, I'm dancing in the kitchen as I'm drying the dishes. Right. It's simple stuff, but we have to do it. So I guess that's, I think that's going to really mean I'm going to have to talk more about joy on Friday. And Friday's going to be tricky because we still haven't figured out, because we're going to have the retreat going on on one Zoom account, and then my class going on. And we still haven't tested that, Angela. Why haven't we done that? We have to do that.
We forgot, but we will.
I know. But it should work. I'll do a little excavating and bring you a few more. I'll bring you that book, How We Choose to Be Happy, and my own book, and see if we can talk some more about this. But I really want to get to equanimity as well. I know each of the, as I, whenever I think about the factors, I'm like, oh, but I really want to spend time on, well, we'll do some time on concentration too. We absolutely have to. But I think I should open it up. Does fishing count? Fishing, it seems perfect as long as you catch and release. Other than that, it's not my business what you do with it. Fishing is a very meditative activity, especially since you never catch anything. Yeah, that's basically requires great acceptance. I used to fish, but the last time I fished was like when I had to like club the fish on the head with a rock. And I was like, oh, I can't do this anymore. This is painful. Anyway, anybody have anything to share or, chip in or ask a question or something here?
Hi, Kevin. It's Angela.
Hello.
Sorry, I have a few things, and then I want to obviously leave just quickly. I just really appreciate this topic, and it just resonated very deeply because I have your book. I haven't read it yet. because it's something that's come up for me a lot in recovery. And I actually got my flute out from, I stopped playing, when it wasn't cool anymore in high school. And I wanted to be in journalism class because I got to get passes to leave campus so I could go smoke weed and,
makes perfect sense.
Yeah. would drink before concerts and parades and all that too, to make my, playing fun. I just got it. I need to like relearn how to read music, but it came to my mind as you were talking about, and I just really appreciate you sharing. Cause it's, I think it's so relatable, and it's like, it's such a, for me, especially, but I just think, and also that Sober Music Fest, this guy who performed the week before you, he said something like just really sweet and touching. He was like, I'm not the best at this, but like it brings me joy. And that's what recovery is about, And it was just so great because it was like he had forgotten some of the words to one of the songs, and he was like, oh, but it was just really like honest and real, and like this is what we go through, just trying to find our way, and people who do it and kind of again light the way for us to say it's okay, to do things that bring us joy, even if we don't think it looks good or is what we're supposed to be doing. And it's just, I don't know, it's such a big, it's like so central to life for me, and the job, how I've been going through the job thing too, and trying to find my joy in my career and life. And my mom always tells me to do things, not to make other people happy, but that's a big thing for me, is like making sure that the people around me and so just when you said knowing what it is that brings me joy, that's a big part of that investigation, is something that I want to do more of, I think, because I just never really asked that question of myself, so I just really appreciate it, and thank you for talking about this.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, you definitely hit on a lot of the issues, I think, And right, I mean, around work, I don't want to put out the suggestion that like, oh, you shouldn't worry about making money. You know, we need a certain amount of money in order to be happy as well. You know, poverty is not like a route to happiness, you know. So it's not simple. You know, it's not, especially work, it's not a simple question that we can just and dismiss. You know, I want to be a gypsy, so I'll just get a van and some, you know, pots and pans and go around. What do they call it? A tinker or whatever they are. Yeah. There's something else you said that reminded me of something. But yeah, I mean, that thing of, you know, as I've been listening to music, and of course, as old people do, I listen to old music a lot, and noticing that a lot of songs I'll hear and I'll think, I remember listening to that when I was high, and I thought they engineered this, particularly the engineering and producing was done in order to like create an effect that people who were stoned would really appreciate, you know, particularly in the late 60s, and you would have the whooshing sounds and, you know, strange guitar sounds and things. And I was thinking like, does that stuff sound good when you're not high? or like, I don't have any more, I can't be objective about it because it's just like in my DNA to like it, you know. But, you know, it's just interesting because some things you listen to and you think, that really sounds stupid. Like, why did they make that? There's some stuff that Jimi Hendrix engineered that it's really frustrating to me. I'm like, wow, I'd much rather hear your guitar just how you're such a great guitar player, but there's like phasing and, you know, stuff that just that loses its quality. Anyway, what's that have to do with joy? Oh, right. Being high, like you have to, you know, you have to be high to go to a concert. Like, how could you enjoy a concert if you weren't high? Like that kind of thinking, right? Amazing. Maybe one more comment, if there is one.
Hey, Kevin. Hey, this is.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Hi, Kevin. Just real quick. This is Michael.
Hi.
I'd also like to mention. I've been sober about 10 weeks now, but I'd like to mention. You know, my about joy in recovery. Joy, you know, maybe not forget that. I guess about 3 or 4 weeks ago, my sponsor got me started reaching out to people, you know, other addicts in recovery. And, you know, this is post COVID. So it's a lot of, most phone calls and it was hard at first, you know, you always hear that picking up the phone is like so heavy, you know, it's just so heavy when you get started. But now I can't wait to pick up the phone. It's like, who am I going to call this afternoon? And I can't even begin to tell you, you know, some of the joy that I get out of calling somebody else in the program. Mm. And, you know, whether, you know, my sponsor's like, he has a British accent too. He's like, you know, Michael, you need to, when you call them, you need to be, make sure that you have service to them. And I'm like, you know, and I practice that too. You know, I've made it part of my practice that like, maybe I don't say that, but actually it's gotten so easy to call people now that I like, how can I be of service to you? How can I help you out? You know? And it's like, I'm sure you all have called people too, and you know, and you're always afraid to call people that like that might have like so many more years of recovery than you. And 9 times out of 10, or 10 times out of 10, they're so grateful that you called them. You know, being a relatively new person in the program, they're so grateful that you called them. And you know, I've had the best conversations with new people, old people. And I mean back to Joy. I mean, I think that would be related, and you know, that's the beauty of relating this Buddhism stuff with the 12 step stuff. And that's some joy for me.
Well, I think it's one of the ways the 12 steps work is that they will tell you to do something for one reason, but then it turns out to have another result, another positive result. And being of service is like probably the number one thing that comes out of recovery is being of service and connecting with people, that, because it's about getting out of yourself. And right, it's like that's where the real happiness, the real joy comes. And you know, they tell you to do it like to be of service to others, but then you quickly discover that it's really what makes you happy. So that's a great note to end on. Thank you.